During these past few years, many of us have been practicing and studying and learning about the paramis, those virtuous qualities that bring us a deep sense of well-being in our lives and that really are onward leading in terms of deepening into our practice. I know Rodney and Sims in general has been offering the practices and kind of understanding of those various 10 paramis. Paramis means virtues of the highest quality, like paramount, paramount. So today I want to talk about one of the paramis called renunciation. And since the theme of our weekend is about letting go, renunciation is all about letting go. So I want to help us to expand and deepen our understanding of renunciation, what that really means in terms of the paramis. It isn't such a popular subject in our society. When we hear the word renunciation, a lot of us can cringe, you know, and feel like, oh, it means that I'm going to be deprived of something when we practice renunciation. We hear a lot and we read a lot about the pursuit of happiness. And mostly for our society, it's about gaining profit and status, getting and gaining material goods or even, you know, knowledge. Mostly in the Dhamma, renunciation has to do with letting go. Of course, there's a lot of happiness to that, which is really what I want to talk about. So, of course, in the Dharma, when you're in the Dharma, I don't know about you, but everything I read, I can kind of put into a Dharma perspective. I can pick up a Newsweek or I can look at the funnies and the cartoons, and I can see some Dharma perspective in there. And one of the places where every once in a while I see something very dharmic is in Hagar the Horrible. How many of you are familiar with that cartoon strip? Okay. So I came across this one cartoon strip, and this one had a pretty pithy perspective to it. There are four frames to it, so just try to picture them yourself. The first frame is when Hagar is climbing up a steep mountain, and it's really, the incline is like almost 90 degrees, and he's huffing and puffing away. And on the second frame, he gets to the top, and he meets this wise sage with a long white beard, and he's sitting cross-legged at the very tip-top of the mountain. And he says, in that second frame, he says, "O sage, please tell me the secret of happiness." In the third frame, the sage replies to him and says, "Simplicity, self-restraint, and renunciation." And the fourth frame, Hagar says to him, "Is there anybody else here I can talk to?" It's like, we don't want to hear this, right? We want something different. We want something that's easy, something that gives us immediate results that are pleasing to us. So along with the title of renunciation, I'm adding the subtitle, The Happiness of Letting Go. Renunciation, The Happiness of Letting Go. Because actually, the practice of renunciation has two sides to it, like the front and the back of one's hand. It's really both the same thing. The first side is known as letting go. We experience it as letting go of something that we're clinging to, not necessarily something that's pleasant all the time. But it can be an attitude, habitual ways of being. We might want to let go of a wrong understanding of our opinions and judgments of things, We might want to let go of the past. So this part of renunciation has to do with the letting go part. We may want to let go, for example, of an object. Like I have a friend who wanted to let go of her of drinking, of places that caused her unhappiness there. So there's letting go of the object, but there's also letting go of the grasping itself to the object. So that's all in the letting go part. And I'm going to kind of open that out a little more later. It's not just letting go of the object that's either pleasant or unpleasant to us, but it's really letting go in a deeper level of the grasping, of the attachment, of the craving, of the clinging. So in the deepest sense, renunciation is about relinquishing the clinging, the craving. But there's a second side of renunciation that I've been trying to point out during these sittings and this morning's practice, and that side is that renunciation is all about letting go into something. It's not just about what we're letting go of, like the object or the clinging itself, but renunciation has a lot to do with what we let go into. We let go into release. We let go into relief. We let go into peacefulness. We let go of ignorance and we're in wisdom, or we open to more wisdom. We let go of stinginess and we open to more generosity. We let go of ill will and we let go into goodwill. So there's more and more of a clear view of what renunciation is all about. So it's not just taking the one side of it and feeling a sense of limitation, but it's a sense of growth when we really understand renunciation deeply. It's a sense of opening into something. And so I've been wanting our practice to carry us into that understanding, into that actual experiential understanding as we've been here today. Just seeing the ways where we feel the complete letting go process, or the complete seeing deeply into the nature of life. So the Pali word, that Pali is the ancient language that the Buddha's teachings were recorded in, not just in Pali, but in other languages. But Pali was the first language that we know of that the Buddha's teachings were recorded in. The word is nekama, nekama. It means actually to go forth. So it's interesting, you know, we have this thing about renunciation means to kind of limit ourselves and to be deprived. That's kind of our Western understanding of renouncing something. Not for everybody, but for a lot of people. But it actually means in the Pali language to go forth. The analogy that's given in the ancient texts is to go out from a place that is confined and dusty. To go out from a place that is kind of small and dusty and kind of filled with defilements in a way, filled with like debris where you can't see clearly. And it's like being in a prison. It's to go out of a prison, go out of a place where, you know, we're confined to ignorance. So this nekama is more about gaining a sense of clarity, gaining a sense of freedom, gaining a sense of peace than what we might think it to be the opposite of. It's letting go into something beneficial. So it's something to remember about nekama. It's letting go into something that's more beneficial. It's not about deprivation. It's more about unburdening, opening, seeing more clearly, having more wisdom. The Buddha says, If one sees that a greater happiness is found by letting go of a lesser one, the wise person will let go of the lesser happiness. So I'm remembering the times that I've been in retreat and far away from home. A particular time when I was in Burma and I decided to stay there for a few months and I had temporarily ordained as a nun. And it wasn't easy to be in the hot weather. I mean, I had at least 3 layers of clothing on, polyester to boot. And, you know, this is what nun's clothing is like. Long sleeve, up to here, you know, inner layer and an outer layer, 3 layers of clothing. Very, very hot. Very needing to put it on in a particular way to represent the lineage in a way that was respectful. I was called to the bathroom at least 3 times to check my robes. You know, you have them on backwards. The hem is showing. It should be on the inside. It's too long. It's too short. And so at a point I was just ready to give up and go home. And of course I missed my home. I missed my own bed and my children and all of that. And I went into the interview. And with one of these teachers we have, Sayadaw Upandita, he knows what's going on before you even open your mouth. You're walking into the room, you know, to say, make your bows and give. And he already knows. He's like, he can read you without saying anything. And so as I was walking in the room, he chanted something in Pali. And so I was listening to the chant and I thought, I recognize this chant. And so then when I was bowing, doing my bows, then the interpreter, my friend, the nun, she was saying in English what it meant. And she was saying, if one sees a greater happiness is found by letting go of a lesser one, the wise person will let go of the lesser happiness. And he was trying to tell me, let go of needing to have that pleasant experience, go home and be with the family, and your mind is heading towards something greater right now. And so we had a little discussion about that, and of course I stayed, but of course I was truthful enough to stay to say that I wish I could go home now. Going on retreat is a radical form of renunciation in relationship to when we're at home. How many of you, probably all of you, have been on retreat? How many of you have not been on at least a 3-day retreat? Yeah, this is your first time, so you know, it's even this, just having this time of quiet and, you know, coming in and sitting 3, 4, 5 times a day. It's a lot to give up. We let go of the ways that we kind of distract ourselves with texting or music or listening to the news or doing something else that we have the habit pattern of doing, anything else but bringing it to watching the mind right here, right now. So we give up speaking, mostly. We give up entertainment and distractions. Mostly we give up reading and writing, except, I mean, we're not reading our novels out there, I don't think. Of course we make our notes. We give up much of our control over things. And we kind of like surrender so that we can really see closely what's happening in our hearts, in our minds. It is a way of simplifying so that we can look inwardly instead of this constant pull to see what's going on outside of us. Constant, powerful pull. We let go of the comforts that we find when we can be at home and just lay down when we want to. So there's a lot of renunciation even happening here. We haven't, at this retreat, we haven't done or offered the precepts, but most of you know the precepts of refraining from from harming or hurting or killing any living being, refraining from taking what has not been offered, refraining from sexual misconduct, conduct that will hurt another or ourselves indirectly or directly, refraining from saying what is untrue, refraining from drugs and intoxicants that will confuse the mind. So all of you, a lot of you already know that when you come into a retreat like this, so you're already taking those precepts, and indeed they're probably for many of you already part of your life anyway. So there's a lot of renunciation that's happening, beautiful renunciation. Renunciation that leads us to the benefit of living wisely, to the benefit of really having a deep sense of well-being. And I think many of us can see that already in our lives as we, no matter whether we're just coming into the Dharma or we've practiced it for many, many years. We experience how this kind of renunciation allows us to see more deeply when the mind isn't regretting or resenting others, regretting what we have done, then we see how much clearer the mind and heart can be, how the waves aren't so kind of engulfing us, how the currents of the mind aren't so strong that they're taking us to places that are unbeneficial for ourselves and others. So when Steve and I, my husband Steve Armstrong, and I offer a retreat, we often have the paramis chanted every evening. So I know many of you have been to our retreat, so I brought the chanting sheet of the paramis along. And what I wanted to read to you is what we usually chant for the parami of renunciation, because it's something that continually impresses me and inspires me. It's a quote by His Holiness Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, one of the great Tibetan teachers who inspires me a lot. So he says about nekama, about renunciation. Renunciation implies the strong wish to free oneself not only from life's immediate sorrows, but from the seemingly unending cycle of conditioned existence. With this renunciation comes a heartfelt weariness and a disillusionment with the endless quest for gratification, approval, profit, and status. And especially those, that last phrase, the endless quest for gratification, approval, profit, and status, kind of points to our clinging to a sense of self, a sense of wanting that approval, wanting to kind of have some stature in life. Or maybe we have the understanding that we're always looking for gratification, eating, you know, sense pleasures. Not to say that that's not good, not some of that is important, you know, indeed for survival. But when it goes on and on without being mindful of it, it goes into habit patterns in ourselves and it causes others a great deal of suffering. So I just want to point out that when we practice each one of these paramis, and I just want to name them in a minute, renunciation is automatically being developed as well. For example, when we practice generosity or giving, we're practicing letting go of stinginess. We're practicing letting go of the fear of lack, of perhaps a poverty mentality, just letting go of ways of being that we kind of blindly cling to. When we practice moral integrity, morality, or living in harmony, we let go of insensitivity to hurting one another with our speech or our behavior. We become more sensitive when we practice moral integrity, all of the five precepts that I just talked about earlier. We come into a sense of deep well-being. When we develop wisdom, we let go of the comfort zone of naivete. When we feel, you know, it feels so comfortable to not know. And it's not true that, you know, ignorance is bliss. Ignorance is really suffering. That's what we find out in the Dharma. How much suffering there is in ignorance, not knowing what, how our actions, how our words, how we blindly go about our lives, not knowing how what we say, what we do, what we don't say, what we don't do affects others around us. When we develop wisdom, we let go of the delusion of seeing things wrongly. We let go of ignorance, not knowing, or not caring to know. When we develop energy, we let go of procrastination. We let go of laziness. When we really turn our minds to bringing more energy to our practice, to our life of being a good human being. When we practice patience, we let go of impatience, of course. And we let go of the arrogance that life has to revolve around my pace. It has to revolve around my schedule or my needs. And we let go of arrogance. Then we come to see what the needs of others are when we develop patience. When we let go of truthfulness, when we develop truthfulness, we let go of deceiving others and ourselves. I told the story last night of when I was at that very first long retreat I went to in Australia. Some people were not reporting their practice truthfully to the teacher. They were kind of exaggerating. You know, they could be with the breath for one whole sitting. I mean, who in the world can do that? Probably not even an arahant, you know. And other things that were like way out of line of being anywhere near truthful. And so that evening, the teacher, that was Sayadaw Upandita, gave a Dharma talk. He doesn't pull any punches, and he kind of says it like it is. He said, I heard many reports today that it's hard to believe that are true. So I want you to look into your own hearts and minds and see if you've really been truthful. And if you haven't been truthful, I would like you to line up next to my door, and I would like you to tell me the truth, that you haven't been truthful, and to tell me that you will be truthful. You will report truthfully, because how can I give you advice if you don't tell me the truth? And so I really checked myself, because I was in that room. You know, did I say... did I exaggerate? Did I hold back? And I thought, actually, I really didn't, because I was astounded that everybody was so advanced in their practice. And I knew I was, you know, fairly a beginner. So I said, well, I just have a lot of sleepiness and restlessness, something like that. And the mind is, it can't settle down. And so I didn't go to the door during that time. But one of the things that Sayadawji Upandita said is, how can you open to the truth? How can you know the truth if you cannot speak the truth? You really have to be not just truthful, but precise in your truthfulness. Not just say that there were a lot of people there, for example, but say, oh, there were some people there. And find the ways that you can really open to precision in what you say, and how you say, and when you say, when the right time is, all of those good things. So we let go of deceiving ourselves. we let go of, you know, ignorance also. So when we practice resolve, I spoke about resolve last night, we let go of wavering, we let go of lingering in doubt, of indecisiveness, we let go of weakness and the lack of courage. When we have resolve, we see all of the opposites of these, the possibility for them to come up. When we practice loving kindness, we let go of ill will. Loving kindness is goodwill. The opposite is ill will. So that's what we let go of. We let go of fear, disconnection with oneself, because really on a very deep level, there is a natural loving kindness there. And so we can find it. We can touch it. It can be nurtured. So we let go of resentment and grudge holding. And when we practice equanimity, we let go of that kind of preference that holds on to one side, that holds on to black or white, you know, and we can't see how things are just all in the middle, really. It's not just one way or another. We can see the various changing ways that things are. We let go of reactivity to aversion, reactivity to attachment. We let go of the habit of dramatizing ordinary experience. We can talk about our practice in ways that maybe in one moment we realize something and we think that this is how I always am. But actually, you know, that's dramatizing who we are. It's just that way for those moments. It's not that way all of our life. So when we develop equanimity, our minds get more spacious and we see the whole range of who we are in a way where we can stay present with it. When we take renunciation in and of itself and practice it on an everyday level, we get a chance to investigate and to be honest with ourselves about what areas of our lives are we holding on to? Where can we not let go? Where is there kind of a clinging, a stickiness? And it's what we've been investigating here all day. Because when we practice renunciation, we not only see the places where we let go, of course, but what comes into clear view are the places where we hold on, where we can't let go. And so both of those have to go kind of hand in hand. We have to be willing to see that part as well. When we come to practice, a lot of times if we don't know that much about practice, we think that what we're going to open to is just all the blissful, all the beautiful, and what's pleasing to us and others. And we're not ready so much to open to the places of us that really hold on, that are really hard to see, that are challenging to open to. So when we come to practice, we really have to come with this sense of adventure that we can open to it all. We can see the places of that are challenging, that are difficult. And with mindfulness, we see how those places can be released by seeing deeply into the nature of reality. We get a chance to really be honest with ourselves. And this is what I love about practice. It's the honesty that, I mean, when I hear you talking about your practice, those of you who are not shy, you know, a lot of you are shy to speak in public, and you're not necessarily just holding back because of dishonesty, but more out of shyness. But a lot of us get really honest with how it is. We're able to say to others and say to ourselves, this is really hard. I see the places in my own heart that where there's a lot of fear, where there's a lot of clinging to an idea of who I think I am, or old idea of who I think I was that's still being carried on into this part of my life, time of my life. when we get more honest with ourselves, there's a relaxation around it. You know, when you can say how it is, we can relax around that expression, around that moment. I feel a sense of calm and peace because somehow, you know, when we kind of keep it to ourselves and it's sort of like a secret, there's tightness in the heart, in the mind. But even when, if you can say to even a dear friend, this is how it is for me around this subject matter, I feel really hurt, or I feel really betrayed, or I feel not good enough sometimes. And just by being able to say it, that kind of, there's mindfulness and there's a possibility of actually saying what we're mindful of. That's why confession is really nice. You know, I was raised a Catholic, and when I was able to say what was going on in my own heart, of course I never always told exactly what was going on in those confessional booths, but when I was able to say something about what was going on, it always felt like there was a sense of relief. And that's, a lot of times, that's what I feel my position is when I hear people talk about, you talk about your lives. It's a chance, it's an opportunity for you, for us to let go, to kind of, someone to bear witness to some difficulty and feel that it's being held by two of us, not just by one of us. So we do experience more calm and peace around that. We get a chance to trade something that we think we're holding on to because it's going to give us safety, you know, some old habits, because we're used to that place of being. But that there's a whole new horizon open to us if we just let go of that old habit. There's a monk, Tanisiro Bhikkhu, who calls this trading candy for gold. You know, that kind of, that sweetness, that's familiarity of the way things we get comfortable with, you know, those old familiar ways we get comfortable with. And it's just, they've just been there for so long that we're just not willing to look in another direction. But there might be some opening where we feel like, okay, we can give this up. We can give this kind of sweetness of familiarity up for something more beautiful, something more freeing. So on an everyday level, in my relationships at home and with my family, when I've had to let go of the need to be right or being right, you know, because of whatever, I'm the mother, or I'm the one who, back in the day when, you know, I was the one filling the refrigerator up, and I could say, look, I'm the one putting the food on the table, and so this is what I'm saying today. And so there were times when I had to be a certain way or else I'd just be overrun by four children. But there were times when I really had to just say, okay, I'm willing to just sit and listen. I don't have to be right. And of course, there were many times like that. My children kind of knocked a lot of sense into me. And that's why I joined the Dharma. That's how I got here. So I find a lot of relief in being able to not be right, to say, oh, there's another way of looking at it. There's another way of seeing this picture. There's another thing to open to, you know, another person suffering, not just my own. We get so wrapped around what's going on in our own minds, in our own hearts, that it's hard for us to see how the other person is suffering. How the other person, you know, the other part of the family or the other parts of our society are suffering. So it really opens us to something bigger. It opens us to compassion. That's the gold. It opens us to wisdom. That's the gold. So I find it such a big relief to feel more spaciousness around that. And we feel the joy of getting along. You know, the joy of feeling like not only that there's some respect coming this way, but we feel that the respect is going out that way too. There's a joy in that, you know, in feeling that things are reciprocal. It's not just a one-way street. So also on an everyday level, not just holding on to being right, you know, holding on to our opinion, our judgments of things, but just on a very practical level, there's being attracted to sensuous, to pleasant objects. This is what, in a very practical, straightforward way, attachment is looking for a pleasant experience to be attached to. So I find in practicing renunciation that when I'm going to look for something in a store, that I start to notice what the mind gets attracted to. First, there's contact with a certain object. You know, there's a color, there's the form, there's the sparkliness of it. And then we see the pleasant feeling that comes out of that contact. So some of you may understand this dependent origination part. You know, there's contact, there's vedana, or the feeling part of it. And immediately after that can come one of the defilements, either attachment if it's pleasant, or aversion if it's unpleasant. So just in a very practical way, this is how I practice renunciation when I go into a store. Although Steve, my husband, doesn't really believe that I'm practicing all the time. Okay, so we can both go into a store. This is not exactly to the point, but we can both go into a store, and you men will know this, most of you. You know exactly what you want. You're going to find underwear, right? It's so boring, but you just go right for it. But I can't do that. It's like, oh, I'm just kind of noticing, you know, woman as the gatherer, just knowing what's out there in case, just in case, you know, I need a new tablecloth for some reason. Oh, that's where the tablecloths could be. Oh, now they have different kinds of towels, the ones that dry easily. Oh, that's on my list for some time. But practicing, really practicing renunciation, I see when I go into the store, the mind takes contact with something, and maybe just noticing it right there. Contact, seeing, smelling, if it's in a restaurant. Hearing, if it's around a music store. You know, sometimes I hear beautiful music and right away it goes to, I want it, I'm already at the cash register. But sometimes it can just be contact with that sense door. And then knowing that wanting will come later on, right at the moment of contact, it can be noticed and dropped down. It doesn't have to go on to the vedana part of feeling and then go on from that into wanting that feeling, or wanting that experience, the feeling that comes with that experience. So we can practice this renunciation every day. As I've been practicing it more, also because, you know, getting older, it's just such a weariness to have to take care of so many things. When I was, a few months ago, I was trying to get some things for going on a trip, going to some cold Colorado, actually, to teach there. And I was going to buy some warmer clothes, and I found myself carrying all these black things into the room, you know, black pants, black shirt, black. So I looked at all of that, and I thought, it's so heavy, you know, to carry. And then I have to try all these on. Trying pants on is the hardest thing for me, you know, mostly because they don't fit. And so I realize how weary the mind is, kind of wanting things, trying them on. I get so happy and relieved when I realize I don't want to do this. Or in the middle, you know, there's 10 things in the trying on closet, and I think I try on 3 things and this is it. I'm walking out. I don't want it. I don't want to do this anymore. There's a story about Socrates. He lived near a market, and he would say, "I love to go and see all the things I am happy without." And so, yeah, I'm really coming to that. Recently, I've been letting go of a lot of my own closet, my own wardrobe. I noticed that I don't pick these things, so I've given about a third of the things away. And some things, you know, just realizing I can live without this and really having that sense of relief and release. But there are some things, you know, I take off the hanger and I put it down, I put back up again, and I just see the attachment to it. Oh, I wore this to my son's wedding. You know, it has some value, but I haven't worn it for 15 years. You know, so put it back. And finally, you know, letting go of it. But watching both sides, watching the place of release and relief when there's renunciation, and noticing what the mind does when there's attachment, too. Have you ever been on Amazon? Amazon's going to take over the world pretty soon, you know, the store. And I had bought something, a pair of slippers. And so now I go on Amazon to get something else, and every pair of slippers shows up on the side. And it says, I wrote, "People who ordered this also ordered these." It says that. And so I think, oh, I could be interested in that. You know, okay, contact, right? And then Vedana, a pleasant feeling comes. I could have a lot of joy getting all of this stuff, and then wanting comes. And then before I know it, I'm clicking on those websites. It's so, they know everything about you. You know? So just noticing how it works in the world. One thing leads to another. One thing leads to another. Contact leads to a pleasant feeling, or even an unpleasant feeling. And then it leads to wanting, it leads to getting, it leads to accumulating, it leads to heaviness, it leads to dukkha, it leads to suffering. Then you have to take care of it, and then you have to be worried that something's going to outdate it, and you have to get another computer, or you have to get insurance for it, or, you know, something breaks, and it just is on and on and on and on. I'm so tired of it all. And then on another level, a deeper level, seeing what happens with this preoccupation with who I think I am, this sense of self. You know, as you were saying a while ago, one can get caught up even in this positive sense of self. One can kind of have a feeling of, oh, this is really me, you know, and that sense of self can get coagulated. But we can get caught up in a sense of, I'm not good enough. Am I okay? This is what happens in my own mind. Not a lot nowadays, but still does. What do they think of me now? What did they think of me in the past? What will they think of me in the future? You know, just letting the mind revolve around that over and over and over again, you can see how it coagulates. What a relief when we see through that preoccupation, when we notice that moment of, oh, I call that moment selfing, a selfing moment. It's important to have one word that kind of lets go of the whole shebang, and you don't need to tell yourself the story of how you did it, you know, when it happened, when it started, how certain people reinforced it in your life. Just selfing. Just seeing selfing, just letting that drop. Renouncing old ideas about oneself that linger. I mean, they're no longer really true, but sometimes in weak moments, don't you all feel that something about your childhood comes up. And you feel it once again in a moment of vulnerability, or maybe similar conditions come up around you, and all of a sudden you feel that sense of like not being good enough, or wanting to please someone, or feeling judgmental of a person or a group or a way of being in yourself or others. And seeing that, gee, haven't seen that in a long time, but then you really kind of let your mind wrap around it and get lost in it. That's why it's really important when we sit to be vigilant about these habit patterns that come up in the mind. Because when we're not vigilant with them, we can get pulled in by them. We get lost and identified with them. So one of the ways of being that cause me a lot of constriction in the mind, a lot of kind of limitation, is, I was raised in an Asian family. My father is Swedish-American. My mother and father parted early on, and so I was raised by a Filipino father and a Filipino mother, and very hardworking. And so I was raised with this very strong work ethic and responsibility to always be doing something, to always be productive, to always be helpful. When my mother would see me not, contributing to the family, and I say this lovingly about my mother, she would say, "Don't be lazy. I'm doing something. Maybe you can help me." And so I would. I don't resent my mother for that either. I just want to make that clear. But that strong work ethic and that sense of, strong responsibility, I'm really working on now. I mean, here I am. I'll be 65 years old this year. And I'm working on that still. I just want to, make you feel good about how, all right about where you might be at. And I'm looking at that and I'm seeing, I have a right to lay down in the middle of the day. I don't have to keep working out there like a dog, I have a right to sit down and read a magazine. My girlfriends will call me and say, "What are you doing?" "Oh, I'm ironing, or I'm working on my Dharma talk, I'm cleaning out the library, I'm pulling the weeds, what are you doing?" "Oh, I'm taking a break, I'm laying down. I'm reading the article you sent me about the joy of quiet." And I say, "Duh. What am I doing? I sent you all, who's on my list, I sent you that article. Did you read it?" So, I'm working on it. I'm working on just being still sometimes. Of course, I go do my retreat time and I have my sitting in the morning and all of that is carved out of my life. But during the day, just strong work ethic. So maybe someday I'll let you know. I'll tell you in a Dharma talk when it's over with. So at a very poignant time in retreat a few years ago, I came to that realization. This thing from the past, this kind of, you got to keep moving, you got to keep contributing to the clan, to the family clan, to helping us all stay together and have it be okay. I saw that in my practice, and I thought, I'm going to pay attention to this more. There's a lot more relief from it now than there was years ago, but still it's there. But I want to read you this parable about Sisyphus that comes from this writing by Stephen Mitchell, Parables and Portraits. And this one is about Sisyphus, and it's kind of in a more exaggerated way. This is how I felt. So this is about a Greek myth where the gods had condemned Sisyphus to ceaselessly roll a rock to the top of the mountain, at which point then the rock would fall back of its own weight and get back down to the bottom, and then he'd go back down to the bottom and roll it back up. And so he was put to this impossible, endless task because the gods thought that there was no more dreadful punishment than this hopeless kind of futile labor. So as Stephen Mitchell writes about the myth of Sisyphus, he says, "We tend to think of Sisyphus as a tragic hero, condemned by the gods to shoulder his rock sweatily up the mountain, and again up the mountain, again and again forever. The truth is that Sisyphus is in love with the rock, like identified. He cherishes every roughness and every ounce of it. He talks to it, sings to it. It has become the mysterious other. He even dreams of it as he sleepwalks upward. Life is unimaginable without it, looming always above him like a huge gray moon. He doesn't realize that at any moment he is permitted to step aside, let the rock hurtle to the bottom, and go home. Tragedy is the inertial force of the mind." So what is it, or where is it in your life that you could let go of that rock that you've been cherishing, that sense of self that really is no longer needed, that's no longer servicing you in your life? Something to really ponder on, that identification with whatever sense of self that's giving you that kind of challenge where you don't feel a deep sense of well-being. Is it wrapped around impatience or arrogance, the need to be right? Is it wrapped around being a victim of the past or any kind of a victim? Can we make room for the present moment where we're creating our future and just let go? So renunciation at its core is really letting go of greed and hatred and delusion, ignorance. And more pointedly, it's letting go of that clinging, that attachment to whatever mind state or whatever conglomeration of mind states that make up this sense of self is or are. Our habit patterns. A lot of suffering comes from that clinging, that identification with whatever that mixture is. On a deeper level, it's really letting go of ignorance, letting go of the illusion that what is happening now will last forever. Of course, nothing lasts. Not what was happening in the past, not even this present moment. Everything is passing away. When we see this over and over and over again in our practice, we really learn to live with the inevitability of change. When we suffer, a lot of times we're holding on to something that we think is still going on in our lives, but really we haven't seen the deep truth of it. Suzuki Roshi says renunciation is not giving up the things of this world, but knowing that they go away. Things, people, ways of being. So tomorrow I'm going to talk about the different forms of attachment so we can identify them more clearly. I just want to talk about a couple of them now so we can kind of let this sink in as we go home this evening and investigate more clearly, more thoroughly. There's one Pali word which describes attachment, and that word is raga, raga. It's a particular word that means lust. It's a state when we feel lust in the mind. It's not just lust for how we think of lust for sexual, gratification, but it's lust for anything that we're so deeply wanting. It's a state of lack, where it comes from a state of lack, that it leads to wanting, it leads to needing so much that we can't see clearly. Always seeking fulfillment, this lust. Its drive is inherently insatiable. We see that it needs to be fed constantly. As long as it endures, it maintains a sense of lack. So knowing what's underneath this kind of mind that goes out looking for gratification, sometimes when we can touch what's underneath, the spell can be broken. This is our human predicament, this constant wanting, seeking happiness by feeding this need for gratification over and over and over again. Sometimes it's really powerful to have, to want something so much. It could be something that you eat, or something that, say, you want to buy, and you go and get it, and then it's right in front of you, and then you say, I'm practicing renunciation. Say, I'm not going to take this now, because it's more powerful. The gold about letting it go is that we develop this sense of restraint, this sense of that it's possible to let go. It's possible not to feed that need for gratification all the time. And that's more powerful than actually getting what we want. To really see the power in that. The other word that's used in terms of describing attachment is tanha. Tanha. It's this depicted as this constant search, and thirst for something that is gratifying. It's like the mind going out looking. And it's because of ignorance. It's very close to the mind that can't see clearly. And tanha is depicted as a person who's thirsty, but instead is drinking salt water and continues to be more and more thirsty. It's this craving to hear, to taste, to smell, to feel, to have mental experiences that give us satisfaction. So kind of two angles on the experience of wanting. This is from the teachings in one of the ancient texts. What is rooted in craving? The Buddha was teaching a group of monks, and so he said, I shall teach you 9 things rooted in craving. Listen and attend carefully. I shall speak. What are the 9 things rooted in craving? Because of craving, there is pursuit. Because of pursuit, there is acquisition. Because of acquisition, there is decision. Because of decision, there is desire and lust. Because of desire and lust, there is selfish tenacity. Because of selfish tenacity, there is possessiveness. Because of possessiveness, there is avarice. Because of avarice, there is concern for protection. For the sake of protection, there is the seizing of cudgels and weapons and various evil, unwholesome things, such as quarrels, strife, dissension, offensive talk, slander, and lies. These are the 9 things rooted in craving. So we can see how, with the craving mind, one thing leads to another, and it ends up in suffering. From the Dhammapada, craving arises in the negligent. The craving of a person addicted to careless living grows like a creeper, jumping from life to life, like a fruit-loving monkey in the forest. So we can see the dangers, we can see the benefits of letting go. And the question is, can we really practice renunciation? if we can practice in our daily life, being in a store, as I pointed out, or being with our family and letting go of the need to be right, just two simple examples, we may be able to carry that renunciation into our moment-to-moment practice, where the mind can let go of greed, let go of hatred, can let go of delusion at the deepest levels. So practicing at very simple levels in our daily life can have a very powerful effect in the deepening of our practice. So I'd like to end by this with this quote by the third Zen patriarch. And really, it's all about letting go and what keeps us from letting go. The great way is not difficult for those who are unattached to their preferences. Let go of longing and aversion, and everything will be perfectly clear. Cling to a hair's breadth of distinction, and heaven and earth are set apart. If you want to realize the truth, don't be for or against. As vast as infinite space, it is perfect and lacks nothing. Because you select and reject, you can't perceive its true nature. Don't get entangled in the world. Don't lose yourself in emptiness. Be at peace in the oneness of things, and all errors will disappear by themselves. So let's sit for a moment.